right, so I'm not Professor Coey, obviously. I think he's at his brother's wedding, pretty sure. So I'm Stephen, for the half of you who don't quite know me. And today we're going to talk about campaigns and elections. And there's three things that I hope that you guys take from this. And I should also say that I like to lecture, but I also like getting questions because it gives me a chance to breathe for a second and take a drink from my water bottle. So if you guys have questions, feel free to interject. Okay, so three things that I want you guys to learn today. So the first one is that the fundamentals of the election, which we're going to talk about what that means, but the fundamentals of the election are a lot better predictors of who wins than what I'll call idiosyncratic events. And we'll talk about what that means. Okay, so the second thing is, insofar as campaigns do affect election outcomes, they do so by influencing whether or not people turn out, and not by persuading somebody to vote, to sort of change who they're going to vote for. It's all about getting your people to turn out, and it's not about convincing the other candidate's person to actually be one of my people. Okay. And then the last thing that I want you guys to take away from today is just how important name recognition is in elections. Okay, so we'll start by talking about how we predict elections. So I pulled this graph. How many of you guys ever go on the blog 538 or are familiar with it or familiar with who Nate Silver is? Okay, so they do lots of cool stuff. And one of the things that they do a lot of is political projections. And so this graph here we're looking at is from 2014, and this is they have like a statistical model, and they're modeling the probability that the Republicans or the Democrats have of having control of the Senate after the 2014 elections. Okay, so this is like purely about predicting who's going to win. So I would say that this activity is not quite what we would call political science. So generally, political science is about explaining things about the way that the world works, and not so much about predicting the future, right? So as social scientists or as researchers, we're trying to understand how sort of the underlying dynamics impact races in kind of broad ways. And it's not so much about, you know, having a model that is perfectly going to be able to predict exactly how many votes this candidate's going to get or that candidate's going to get. Okay, so given that we generally are all about explaining and predicting, elections is actually one area where we regularly do get into this task of making predictions, and so we'll apply our theories to outcomes. And in fact, we do a pretty good job of it, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Okay. So the fundamentals of the election. So presidential elections, and to a great extent, other elections, and for the Senate or for the House or for governor or for even, frankly, lower down elected offices, they're super, super predictable, right? Based on what I'm going to call the fundamentals. And so I'm going to make this distinction between the fundamentals and essentially the campaign. So the fundamentals, what I mean here is, the fundamentals are the set of things that basically nobody has much control over. No individual candidate can do something to manipulate sort of the underlying fundamentals of an election. So one of these is just incumbency, right? You guys have probably heard of like the incumbency advantage, and it's just this idea that incumbents win elections a lot. If you go back to 1900 and just look at every time an incumbent president was running for re-election, they won re-election 79% of the time. It was like, I want to say it was like 15 out of 19 times, right? So if you know nothing else about a presidential election except that the incumbent is running for re-election, it's a pretty, like if you have to place a bet, pretty safe to bet on the incumbent. So that's a fundamental, right? While a campaign's going on, you can't change who the incumbent is. Nobody can, it's kind of dark, but, like, I guess if a president died, you could change that. But setting aside those things, nobody, like, legally can manipulate who's the incumbent. Okay, so another fundamental, and this is incredibly important, and interestingly, like, how the economy is doing not only impacts how people vote for president, but it impacts how people vote all the way down the ticket, which is kind of fascinating because your, like, say your local state representative, somebody in the state house who represents a few thousand people in your area, they have basically, they personally have little that they can do to manipulate if the economy is growing or not in your area or nationally. And even, frankly, the president, I mean, we talked about this earlier in the semester, frankly, the president doesn't have all that much power to really, really make big shifts in how well the economy is doing. And yet, they're being held accountable for it. So the general trend is that when the economy is doing well, people don't want to rock the boat. Okay, so the economy is doing well, incumbents do well. If the economy is doing badly, then people say, we got to mix it up, let's just put a different party in there. You know, the Republicans have been, the economy's going well and the Republicans are incumbents, let's keep them. The economy's going poorly and the Republicans are in office, let's put the Democrats in and see if they can shake it up. Okay, so that's another fundamental. And then another, the last one, and certainly there's others, but these are kind of the big ones, is just this idea of war and peace. That when we're in times of peace, people generally are happy with the president. That if you have like big catastrophic wars, there's sort of, you know, a mixed story there, and that when right at the beginning of wars, often the president kind of gets a bump. There's this idea of a rally around the flag effect. We just talked in my section, I alluded to this, but in 2001, for example, after 9/11, if you go on Gallup's website, so Gallup does presidential polling, and you look at the Gallup polls about asking people, do you approve of the job President George Bush is doing? If you look at like the week and the couple weeks after September 11th, he went from like 55% to like 93%. It skyrocketed. That's rally around the flag. It's the idea that like when we perceive like a foreign adversary in a war context or in a terrorism context or something like that, we, you know, embrace our institutions and we love the president and we're going to do everything we can to win this thing. But what we see, though, is that as wars go on, we see that erode quite a bit, and actually it can be a drag on presidents. If you think about, like, the war in Vietnam or even the war in Iraq, that those eventually became bad things for the president, like, for how people thought about the president. People were upset. Okay? So based on these three fundamentals, we get just this general trend, which is that incumbent presidents who run for re-election in times of peace and prosperity are basically guaranteed to win.
So for like incumbent presidents who are running again, they're likely to win after, I guess, their term is up. Is it likely that the party switches, or does it typically stay like the same, or is there no real correlation?
Yeah, so in fact, this is what I'm about to introduce is just a really basic statistical model that just uses these three criteria to estimate who's gonna estimate what percentage of the vote each party is going to get. But there are other models, and a lot of those include, they include in their model the idea of whether or not the party, the incumbent party, has been in there for more or less than 8 years. Because we do find this trend that basically after two terms, parties lose support. So for example, coming up in 2016, the Democrats have been in they've held the White House for 8 years. And so statistically, we're probably going to see them do a couple percentage points worse in the national polls than they would otherwise. If everything else were the same, they would do, you know, they're going to do a little bit worse because, you know, you think about it from sort of a psychological perspective. They've been, you know, they've held the White House for 8 years. Everything that went bad in the last 8 years, the Republicans can pin on the Democrats, and right, and that's, you saw this in 2008 as well. The Republicans held the White House from 2001 till 2000 till 2008. Everything that went bad in those 8 years, whether or not the Republicans had anything to do with it, the Democrats tried to pin on the Republicans. And so, yeah, so we do in fact see that people are kind of ready for a shift after two terms. We see this pattern. So the thing to notice about all these fundamentals is that they don't have anything to do with the campaign, right? we know sort of the status of the economy, we know the status of the war, we know the status of incumbency well before the campaign even starts. I mean, we know now, we have a decent sense now, although, you know, we'll typically when we do these statistical models, we use data from a little bit closer to the election on economic growth and that sort of thing. But we have a general sense now of what the economy is going to look like, and we know we're probably not going to be, like, getting involved in a major war in the next few months, hopefully. And we know that the incumbent will be Obama. And so we don't have any clue whether it's going to be, we certainly have no clue on the Republican side. And even on the Democratic side, we don't have a perfect sense of who the nominee is going to be. And yet, we can still do a pretty decent job of predicting who is going to win. Now, I realize I say this, and I'm sort of suggesting that I'm like going to show you a graph and show some projection for 2016. I don't have that. I haven't collected any data for this year at all. But toward the end of the summer, there's a bunch of political scientists who each sort of have their own little model. And they come out, like, there's like a journal that publishes all of these, and generally they're pretty spot on. So getting back to this, these fundamentals don't have anything to do with the campaign, and when you listen to the media and when you listen to just general how people talk about presidential elections and even elections for other offices. We talk about like, oh, well, this debate was a game changer because this person looked really good. Or, you know, Donald Trump said this and it was awful and he's doomed, right? Like these like gaffes and debates and campaign, like TV advertisements, all these sort of things. I would lump those together as sort of, those are the campaign, those are the idiosyncratic elements of an election that change from year to year and the campaigns can obviously manipulate what kind of ads they're running, or to an extent they can manipulate how well they do in the debate by preparing well or something like that. But the broader point here is that the fundamentals are so strongly tied with election outcomes that we can get really, really accurate estimates of what percentage of the vote the Democrats are going to get and the Republicans are going to get well before the campaign even starts. Okay, so the forecasting model I'm about to show you guys is Hibbs. It's called the bread and peace model, and it's essentially all it uses is economic growth. I should have looked this up a minute ago. I think it's like the real GDP growth. Does that sound right to use GDP? I don't remember. Some sort of economic indicator, and then the number of military casualties. Basically, those two things put together uses those to predict how well candidates will do. So this is what it looks like. Okay, so on the x-axis is sort of his, you know, he has a method for combining together income growth and military fatalities. And you can see, and then over here is what share of the vote the incumbent party wins. You can see it lines up well, right? You know, certainly you get elections where it's off the path, right? You get some elections like, you know, look at 64, it's right on the money. And then you get some where, 2000, remember 2000 was when Bush was running against Gore, and it was basically tied. Gore won a few more votes nationally, but we get a big gap here. But if you just, you know, if you look at the whole graph, you can see that there's a pretty strong correlation between something that we know months before the election and what's going to happen in the election. And so this is the prediction for Obama in 2012 when economic growth wasn't great and the wars were still going on. In fact, this 2012 was, with this model in particular, some of the other models did a lot better, but this model was actually quite far off in 2012 that he overperformed the prediction. Okay, so this kind of leads me to the theme of what I'm going to talk about today, which is the question of, does this just mean that campaigns don't really matter at all? If before the campaign even happens, if we can be pretty decently accurate at predicting how the vote is going to come out. Just sort of suggests we're wasting a bunch of time and money and energy on the campaign. Okay? So that's going to be sort of where I'm going from here on out. But before I go there, I'm going to talk briefly about sort of an alternative approach to predicting elections. This is sort of where I started. So this is also a graph from 2012. So this is from 538 as well. And this is Nate Silver's projection model of what percentage of the popular vote each party is going to get. Okay? Now, what's different about this is that this is largely based on polling data. And so polling data is going to take into account, right? If you're doing polls every week during the campaign, it's going to take into account when there is a gap and people react to it and that sort of thing. But generally, as political scientists, we like to think of those as like not as interesting. We're looking for the story about the forest and not the little individual trees, the little thing that happened in this particular election that explained it. So a couple things I'll throw out here about this model. So one interesting thing you can see is like the jaggedness and this over here. We'll talk about that in a second. But you can just see that like the projection fluctuated and there's like ebbs and flows to it. So one way to think about these differences is, first, it's just random noise, right? You think about like anytime you see survey results being reported, political polling, they say like plus or minus 3 points. Usually, it's usually what they target. That means that like, you know, the true estimate is probably somewhere within 3 points. But when you're estimating that one candidate has 51% support and the other has 49% support, if it's plus or minus 3 points, you know, it could be flipped, right? Like more people could actually prefer the one who's behind in this poll. You might have just had a sample that happened to suggest otherwise. So that's a little bit of this. And that's why, so one thing to think about, the primary hasn't quite been like this, but in the general election, I can 100% guarantee that come September, all the news networks every week are going to be talking about, like there will be a new poll that comes out, and they will talk incessantly about how candidate X is up 2 points in this poll. And it's like, was that because he had a really good speech last week? It's like, no. If the swing is 2 points and the margin of error is 3 points, that's not very interesting. That's not a very interesting swing. You know, if you had run the exact same poll at this, like simultaneously, you just did it twice with two samples of people, you might have gotten that candidate who you thought went up 2 points actually went down 2 points. So that's something to think about, is like the media way overplays these little tiny fluctuations from day to day in the polling. But we see something like this. So this is kind of interesting. I would say that's a pretty sizable drop. And if you look at what that corresponds with, this graph isn't interactive, but on the website it's interactive, and you can find the date where that drop started. And that date corresponds with, in 2012, the first debate between Obama and Romney. I don't know, do any of you guys remember that debate? What was sort of the narrative that came out of it? Probably not. Do you even remember, Justin?
Yeah.
You do? Okay.
Yeah.
Did we watch it together? Did you watch it? See, just yet. So, in that debate, Obama did horrible. Like, he just, I don't know what was up. I'm sure there are books written about it at this point. But he did objectively quite poorly. And so the reaction was that people were like, oh, man, gotta vote for that Romney guy. And so this is an example, right, where you do see this noticeable drop-off. But broadly speaking, In research on this question, so like there's this interesting empirical question, is like, does the winner of a debate tend to, how big of a bump does the winner of a debate tend to get, and does that bump, you know, does that end up helping them in the actual election results, like that happen a lot later, and the finding is, yeah, there can sometimes be a bump, and it kind of just depends. This is an example where there's a big bump, but generally, it exists for a couple weeks and then it just sort of erodes away. That it goes back pretty quickly to where it was before the event happened. And so you can sort of see it eroding away here. And part of the reason it doesn't erode away more is that, like, the model that he's using here is, like, using, I don't know how to explain it. It's like a weighted average of basically, like, this point right here is a weighted average of all the data from this whole time series. So there's, like, this is all still in there at the end. But if you just look at, like, the polls in the last couple weeks, this bump disappeared pretty quickly. Yeah. Going to win this debate? My candidate is always going to win the debate. That's how it works. That's a good question. I don't recall exactly how they do it in these papers. I would guess that it's we do get polling right out. Like often in the polls where they ask who you support, they also say, "Did you watch the debate? Who do you think won?" And even though most people will say that their candidate won, you can still, I would say, like, Obama did poorly enough that there were probably a lot of Obama supporters that said, yeah, Romney probably won that one, right? So there's still a little bit of a signal in that noise. I can't say for certain, but I think that's probably how they're picking this up. So that's an important point here is that the little things that happen throughout the campaign that people pay a ton of attention to, that the media especially pays a ton of attention to, in terms of how the vote's going to end up, often they don't really have an impact. I guess I have it on a later slide, but I'll say it here. The one kind of exception is when you have something that happens maybe right before the election. So in 1980, for example, 80 was incumbent President Jimmy Carter was running against Ronald Reagan, and they had one debate, and the debate happened like 6 or 8 days before Election Day. And Carter did really poorly. And potentially, because it was so close, there were people who went to the polling station, you know, on Election Day, and maybe the fact that the debate was so recent that it influenced how they voted. And sort of the result of that is that nowadays, like, presidential debates, there's interesting things that have been written about them, but the, like, the logistics and the elaborate set of rules that the candidates negotiate on and agree on are set way beforehand, and there's a ton that goes into them. But the one thing that all the candidates always want nowadays is to make sure that the last debate is at least a few weeks before the election. Because as a candidate, you want to be able to control as much as you can. And so you don't want to lose a presidential election or any kind of election based on the fact that you had one crappy 2 hours on, like, the Saturday before Election Day, right? You didn't do super well in the debate and everybody knew it and that costs you the election. Candidates do not want that to happen. And so nowadays, I won't be surprised if we ever see a presidential debate happen so close to an election ever again for that exact reason. The other thing I'll throw out there about this graph is I don't exactly remember how far back, like, I don't know what the x-axis here, but this is at least several months beforehand. The other thing to remember, and you've seen this in some of your readings, the other thing to remember is that most people are not thinking about the election. Think about it now. Like, we have all these polls of, like, who would you vote for if Trump were running against Clinton or if Clinton were running against Cruz, that sort of thing. Most voters, most people, there's going to be about 130 million people that vote in November. I would say at least, I'm making this up, but I would say probably 100 million of them have given very little thought to who they're going to support in the election. And so in some sense, it's like when you're asking so far ahead who you're going to vote for, people haven't given it much thought, and so they're just sort of going to, who knows how they're going to answer. Probably they're likely to say that they'll vote for the Democrat if they're a Democrat, or the Republican if they're a Republican. But it, I mean, think of it this way. If I ask you, today's Thursday, if I ask you, what are you going to have for breakfast on Tuesday? That's kind of an absurd question. Like, who knows? I could, you know, if I were asked that question, then I would say, well, like, the fundamentals of my like, breakfast routine are that I usually have Honey Nut Cheerios for breakfast, which is a fact. So I'll say I'm going to have Honey Nut Cheerios, but clearly you'd be way better off asking me that question when I wake up on Tuesday morning than a week before. And so that's part of why, like, this activity of, like, predicting the election based on polling data is useful, and it's interesting, but frankly, if I gave you the polling data from all 50 states the week before the election, like if I gave you a poll that happened in all 50 states before the election, you all could probably pretty accurately predict who's going to win, because whoever's ahead in the polls in the last week is probably going to win. So in some sense, this is, like, less interesting. It's like, well, of course he got right on the money. Like, this model gets right on the money because we've been at, it's using information that we asked just a couple days before election day. Yeah.
So is that kind of the same thing in the reading that was, like, on the quiz? So it's saying it's, like, the closer it is to election, the more solidified in people's, like, opinions they are, the more they're going to vote for.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, so most people don't start thinking about it. So if I ask you 6 months before the election, like now, who you're going to vote for, you'd probably, like, most people, you could probably get a good sense of it, but you're going to get a lot more accurate an answer if you ask them the day before or 2 weeks before or whatever. And there's a lot of reasons, but one reason is just that people aren't thinking about the election yet. They're not thinking about these things. They frankly don't know who some of the candidates are at this point. Okay, so let's press on. So if campaigns don't matter, then why is there so much? I actually already answered. I'm going to skip ahead. So some reasons why campaigns might not matter. So the first one is what I've already talked about, which is that there's basically no evidence that debates or speeches or gaffes impact the election as much as conventional wisdom or as much as the media likes to play them up to be. And granted, I've given you some caveats that, like, when something happens right before the election, that maybe has an impact. Another great example of that is from the 2004 election. Do you guys remember the 2004 election? Y'all are a little young, maybe. I don't know. In 2004, something that happened. So do you guys remember how, like, all through the first decade of the 2000s, Osama bin Laden would, like, roll out one of these videos every so often, and it would be, like, a big deal, and he would, like, talk about how awful America is, whatever. So in the 2004 election, we hadn't heard anything from Osama bin Laden for several months, and just a few days before the election, one of these videos came out, and it was an opportunity for President Bush to play up how important it was that we, you know, his campaign theme back then was stay the course and continue doing what we're doing, because we gotta continue on this path. So that's maybe an example. It's really hard to say for sure how much that was actually swinging people's votes, but. Something that happens right before the campaign. Sometimes you call this the October surprise. Is that the term I'm looking for? Is that right, Justin? October surprise, something like that. Yeah, like stuff that happens around Halloween. I was thinking of something, the term is something to do with Halloween, but maybe not. Stuff that happens around Halloween, basically the week before, maybe it can, it certainly has more of a chance of having an impact on the election. But something that happens in August, probably not. Okay, another reason. People don't pay much attention to the campaign. And like I said, most people haven't given a consideration to who they're going to vote for. Another one is that it's basically impossible to persuade a Democrat to vote for a Republican or a Republican to vote for a Democrat. And if you guys were in, for those of you who were just in my section, I talked about how, we like to talk about how there's all these independents, but in fact, people who are very, that there's only about 10 or 12% of Americans who are truly independent in the sense that they do have a decent chance of voting either Democrat or Republican. It's a pretty relatively small chunk of folks. And then the last thing, this is based on kind of new research, but I find it kind of interesting to think about, which is that, you know, think about who are the people who volunteer for campaigns, right? The people who are going and knocking on doors and trying to convince people to turn out. It's going to be the most liberal or the most conservative people, the strongest, you know, you, if you're kind of in the middle, you're not going to go volunteer for a campaign. But if you're very strongly supportive of your candidate, then you're going to go volunteer for that campaign. But they're going to send you to go talk to people who are very torn. And so it becomes what's called a principal agent problem, which is that the people who are, you know, the volunteers trying to do the convincing are not very good at talking to moderates because they can't wrap their head around this idea. How could you possibly be torn about this election? It seems so clear. And so frankly, so that's just something else to think about why campaigns are sort of bizarre in that we get strong partisans trying to convince moderates that they like to come to their side, but frankly, they probably can't really empathize with the moderate perspective because they're themselves pretty more likely to be on the extremes. Okay, flip side. So why campaigns might matter. So campaigns force people to think about politics. This is sort of the one moment in a four-year cycle where people actually pay attention to politics, right? And so there's a lot of learning that goes on during the campaign. You learn about the policy positions of candidates, but also, and I would say this is equally as important, right? We like to lament the fact that there isn't a lot of policy discussion that goes on in campaigns a lot, or there's not as much as we'd like there to be. But on some level, I think especially for president, learning about personalities and the candidate's temperament is like equally as important, right? Because I think the reason I say that is because especially for president, you elect somebody and you think you know what the things they're going to be dealing with are going to be, but basically, in every four-year term, something happens that we had no idea was going to happen when we elected the person. So we want people who have good judgment and good temperament, right? When we voted in 2000, the big issues were like Social Security and economics and like personal like ethics, that sort of thing. But the huge thing that dominated that next four-year window was 9/11 in response to terrorism. So in some sense, the campaigns are useful for us to learn about the person as an individual and have trust that this is the person that I want making decisions for me. I think this person has good judgment, that sort of thing. So yeah. Another thing of why campaigns might matter is that campaigns help build name recognition. So a lot of what I've been talking about today has been about presidential campaigns, but And frankly, by the time the November election rolls around, everybody who's going to vote is going to know both the names of the two candidates. But in lower down races, that's not necessarily the case. And frankly, like, you're way more likely to vote for somebody if you just have heard their name before. And I'll tell you a really depressing story. I volunteered for a campaign in 2008, and a couple weeks before the campaign, I was cold calling people to ask for money, which is horrible. It's not fun. And in fact, we were calling people who we had like a database of phone numbers, and these were people we knew were strong partisans on our side because they had donated to a bunch of candidates on our side beforehand. And it was really depressing because I called and I was like, "Hi, I'm calling to raise money for this candidate," and these were strong partisans, and they're like, "I have never heard of that person. Like, I will vote for them in November, but I'm not going to give you money. I've never even heard of them." And so that's just like a sort of a small anecdote about why name recognition is really important, because it just makes the whole game a lot more difficult if people don't know who you are. And we'll talk more about name recognition in a minute. Okay, so the last thing about why campaigns might matter is, yes, we might not convince a Republican to vote Democrat or vice versa, but we can get they might be able to help people turn out to vote. So this is why, you hear this term about mobilizing the base in a presidential election. So, Democrats want to get all their people out to the polls and make sure they knock on on election day. Obama was quite good at this in both of his elections. They had lists of people that they were pretty confident were going to vote for them, or that if they got to the polls, they would vote for them. And so they were knocking on your door You know, in states where there was early voting, they were knocking on your door weeks before, making sure, it's like, have you voted yet? It's like, yeah, I did. And then said, okay, well, we can check you off the list and not come back. Or on election day, it's you know, all about going and knocking on doors and trying to get people to turn out, or calling people, that sort of thing. And there's some really good experimental political science research that shows that one of the most effective ways to persuade people to turn out is through what's called social pressure. And so there's a cool experiment from, I guess it's about 10 years ago now, but they sent like a little card in the mail and it to voters, and the experiment was like, I guess there were some people didn't get the card, some people got a card that like didn't, it just said something generic about the election, and then some people got a version of the card that said, here's your voting history in the last two or three elections, like did you know, you voted in this one, you didn't vote in this one, you voted in this one. Here's your neighbor's voting history. After the election, you know, so it's important to vote, so remember to vote. And after the election, we're going to, by the way, we're going to follow up and send your neighbors this card and let them know if you, like, let everybody in your neighborhood know who voted and not. And so that produced, like, a significant bump in turnout among the people who got that message. So the idea of, like, I'm going to go vote because I'm being, like, socially pressured into doing it is pretty effective. But frankly, that there aren't a lot of, that's like a rare case of something that actually does impact turnout. It's really tough to change, it's virtually impossible to change people's vote decision, whether they vote Democrat or Republican, but it's also quite difficult to change people's turnout behavior. People who vote all the time, vote all the time. People who never vote, never vote. And there's not a ton of people in between, at least in presidential races. So, something else to think about. Okay, so then, do campaigns matter? So, one way I like to think about campaigns, so when we say, like, we can predict the outcome of the election months beforehand, so maybe campaigns don't matter. One way to think about whether, you know, just stepping out of political science world and just more into, like, statistics and causality world. If we say that A causes B, what we're essentially saying, like the effect of A on B is what happens in B if A happens minus what happens in B if A does not happen, right? Does that make sense? So it's like if A is there versus not there, how does B change? Okay? So when we say like do campaigns have an effect, it's kind of hard to say whether or not they have an effect because we've never observed an instance where, for example, a presidential candidate didn't have a campaign, right? So we've never observed that. And in fact, the graph that I showed you guys in the models, the statistical models of showing how well the pre-election stuff impacts the vote, that all assumes that there's going to be a campaign in between there and that both candidates are going to have debates and rallies and ads and all of that. So one way to think of the campaign is that it's kind of pushing people toward the way that the fundamentals suggest that they should be acting. So if the economy is booming, the incumbent party's campaign is going to remind everybody about how they're responsible for everything good in the universe. Okay? And when the economy is shrinking, the out party reminds people that things have never been worse in the history of the universe, and that the world is going to definitely end in the next 4 years if they're not elected president, right? Obviously a caricature, but this is really what we see, and this is this idea that the campaigns push the voters in the direction that the fundamentals suggest they should kind of get to. Okay. A couple other instances where campaigns might matter. So in a lot of elections, a lot of candidates are not very well known. Certainly not the case in presidential races, but you get on to House races or local races, all that sort of thing. Or even in primary elections, candidates aren't especially well known. So a campaign can help build a candidate's name recognition. Another instance is when resources are unequal. So we don't really see this in presidential races either, but in lower down races, you see huge disparities in spending between candidates often. And just a little fun fact, the more in US House, the more an incumbent spends, the more likely they are to lose. So why do you guys think this is the case? Anybody have a guess? Does anybody else have, that's a good thought. So what about, so this is in the U.S. House, an incumbent running against some random person that has no chance of winning, the incumbent's not going to, they don't have any incentive to spend a lot of money. When they're spending a lot, it means that they're afraid because they have a really good challenger running against them, right? When the challenger spending ramps up, which most challengers don't spend very much money, but when they do, the incumbent then has to spend a ton more money. And so it's those cases where the incumbent is spending more money precisely because they think they're going to lose because they're running against a good candidate. So that's just another interesting thing. We're going to talk more about money in politics in a few weeks, but I think it's kind of cool. Another instance is like when a candidate runs an unusual or non-optimal campaign, maybe it matters then. And again, this doesn't really happen in the presidential level, but you know, there's a lot of instances of candidates for U.S. House who literally just don't run a campaign. They'll get the nomination and then spend, you know, less than like $10,000, which in campaign world is not very much money, and they don't really have any events or anything like that. I don't really understand why, well, there's reasons why these people exist, but it's another thing. Okay, so let's talk about name recognition. So let's talk about name recognition in the presidential race, right? So by the time we get to the general election, we can basically assume that both candidates are going to be pretty well known. But in the primaries, it's not necessarily the case. So I'm going to break down some of the primary candidates into a couple categories. So Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have universal name recognition, and they did before the election. I would say like 90%+ of Americans know those two names. A step down, you've got like Jeb Bush, right? I think I've heard of that guy. I think maybe his like cousin or brother or something was president, I think, something like that. He has pretty good name recognition. Then below that, you've got the like, who the heck is that category, which is, you know, a lot of candidates fall into this one. Before the primary happened, say most Americans had no idea who any of these names were. And then even below that is like, actually, no, really, who is that? Which still, like, even people who pay attention to politics had no idea. I collect campaign bumper stickers, and I got one from Jim Gilmore, and I, like, was showing people around my office, and we're all people who study American politics in a PhD, and some of them had literally never heard of Jim Gilmore. So that just, like, illustrates how much of an uphill battle these folks, and to an extent these folks, have to, like, build name recognition, because who's going to vote for Jim Gilmore if you've never heard of Jim Gilmore? Okay, so the last thing I'm going to end with is talking about the media. So name recognition is often built through media attention. So I just have some graphs of some data about how much coverage the media has been giving to different candidates. So hopefully you guys can kind of see this. So, and I'll explain it. So this goes back to January 1st, 2015, all the way up until yesterday or 2 days ago. And this is in all national, like CNN, Fox, MSNBC, like the local, the ABC, like nightly news, all those, the total number of mentions that in the black is Hillary Clinton and in the green is Bernie Sanders. And then you see, like, you can barely see the blue and the orange are the other Democratic candidates. So you can see out here that up until basically, where are we? This is where the Iowa caucus happens. This is when primary voting actually started. And up until that point, Clinton was getting a ton of coverage, and Sanders was not. But if we zoom in, we can see that the green line again is Sanders, that Clinton and Sanders have been getting it would be hard to make a case that one of them is getting substantially more coverage than the other. And part of this is like, you know, it's going both ways, that the media is talking about Sanders more because he has more name recognition, but also the fact that they're talking about him makes his name more recognizable to people, okay? So to contrast that, this is the Republicans, and you can probably guess who the blue line is. At the top is Donald Trump, and this is over the last 3 months. I can't imagine how frustrating it is to be any other Republican candidate who in any other year would be getting a ton of attention from the media, but Donald Trump is just dominating media attention. So it's making it really hard for Kasich and Cruz to like get ahead when the media isn't really talking about them. And frankly, I have no evidence to back this up, but my guess is that people probably know Bernie Sanders' name. Just the average American probably knows Bernie Sanders' name better than they know John Kasich's name, even though they're both one of the last few people running for president. And I think it's largely because the media never talks about Kasich, but Sanders is getting a lot of coverage. And the very last thing I'll show you guys is, in politics, frankly, no press is bad press. So just having people talking about you is the name of the game, even if they're saying bad things. And so this is based on data from all, what was this? This is like, I don't think it actually says. It's data from Crimson Hexagon. So they pulled data from like basically all printed news reports across the country. And what's interesting is that the two front runners, and so they have like a machine learning algorithm that codes like mentions of Clinton as, is it a positive mention or a negative mention? They do that for all the candidates. And what's interesting is that the two front runners are getting the most negative coverage, which is strange, I think, for sure. But, you know, no news is bad, or no, I don't, what's the aphorism? I don't know. Yeah, there's no such thing as bad press. So that's all I've got. Thanks for listening, guys, and we'll see you next week.